This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and here we are once again. Time flies because it is already time for another rousing session of Q&A with Layla.
Yay!
Where we answer your questions. Yes, we're excited. We're excited because we really love receiving your fascinating questions and tackling them. You can send questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. And with me today, as usual, is our nutritionist in residence, Layla Mudin. She's a registered dietitian. And she also has a master's degree in the field of nutrition. And we see patients side by side at our practice in Manhattan. And she also has an independent practice. So you can see her or you can see both of us together. So how are you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And before we get to questions, by the way, the destination for questions is radioprogram@AOL.com. Radioprogram@AOL.com. Big article in the New York Times. And what I have said about the Times is that you can almost reliably set your clock back 20 or 30 years in the field of nutrition, and the Times will have discovered it.
Oh.
So when the Times reports on something, you just have to go, you know, it's not 1983, it's 2018, actually.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Uh-huh.
Because this, to me, is the duh story of the month.
And it
has to do with type 1. It says how a low-carb diet might aid people with type 1 diabetes.
Oh,
do
my.
Tell. Oh, my goodness.
Really?
You know, so, of course, we know
that
type 2 diabetes patients are obese.
Yeah.
They become insulin resistant. It's a no-brainer. I mean, I think that that's now common knowledge that a low-carb diet is extremely effective.
It's the antidote.
Yeah, I mean, if you tell me, you know, go on a low-fat diet, eliminate meat for, you know, type 2 diabetes.
And eat lots of beans and rice. No.
No. It's not, I mean, it might be better than eating Big Macs all the time. You know,
sure.
And drinking,
it's better than the donut
drinking
diet.
Drinking milkshakes or something, you know.
Yeah.
But that's not going to help type 2 diabetes. But now type 1 diabetes. Okay.
Yeah.
So this is how the reasoning has gone for the past. It dominated the thinking in type 1 diabetes for 50 years, is you would get carbohydrate equivalents. You know about this.
Carbohydrate counting.
Yes. You would count carbohydrates, and then you would cover with insulin.
Yeah.
So it would be like, don't worry about the carbohydrates because
you have insulin to take care of it.
Even though your body's not producing insulin, you'll have insulin to bring your blood sugar down. Mm-hmm. So, if you're having a high carb meal, just take a little more insulin.
Yeah.
Right? No problem. You'll adjust your blood sugar. So, they talk in this article in the Times as if it's a big revelation that, if you take in less carbs, you will need less insulin.
And that would only be a good thing.
Right. Now, what's fascinating about that is my first exposure to this idea came literally 35 years ago when I was in med school.
Mm-hmm.
It was longer than that because I started med school almost 40 years ago.
Okay.
And so I had this oddball classmate whose name was Dr. Richard Bernstein. He wasn't a doctor. He was a med student.
Yes.
But he was an interesting guy because he was actually the oldest med student in our class.
Uh-huh.
I had taken a few years off before I went to med school. So I was an older med student at 25.
Oh, my.
But he was already in his mid-30s at the time. And he was a type 1 diabetic. And he did an odd thing because every few minutes, he would almost in an obsessive way be checking his blood sugar. And one of the reasons he got into med school is because he was an engineer who developed the method for finger sticking.
Wow.
And so he was already had professional credentials, and he said, I want to now become a doctor. Mm. So he also was a proponent of what was then very unpopular, which was the high fat, low carb, very low carb diet. And he was managing his diabetes that way.
Yes.
On the theory that he would need less insulin. Mm-hmm. But he also used tiny amounts of insulin, you know, six times a day, very obsessive routine to manage his blood sugar. And then, of course, he wrote books on the subject. He became a controversial expert on this. I remember, you know, interviewing him through my radio career and subsequently agreeing with him. I, at the time, was a vegetarian, low-fat acolyte.
Macrobiotic.
I was macrobiotic at the time. So I would be debating him about, you know, how potentially bad this was to be consuming so much fat and meat. Mm-hmm. He turned out to win the argument on that. I will readily concede. Mm-hmm. So this idea is not novel. And in fact, they do credit him in this article in the New York Times.
Oh, good.
Yeah, they actually mention him. But they really don't go back to the antecedents. The antecedent is a guy named Banting. And
yes.
Banting actually was the discoverer of insulin.
Uh-huh.
And Banting dealt with a lot of diabetics. And how you dealt with diabetics in those days, by the way, Joslin as well.
The Joslin
who developed the
Blossom Center.
Clinics. Mm-hmm. A few years back, they had an exhibit on the origins of insulin.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at the New York Historical Society. It was very interesting because you saw the diaries of some of the young kids who had diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
And what they did is they very scrupulously wrote down the amount of carbohydrates, fat, and protein that they had. And they were urged to be on a very low-carb diet because there's no insulin then.
Yeah, that's right.
And they actually kept those kids alive and in a semblance of health with a very low-carb diet. It was the only thing they had. They did not have any other means of keeping those kids alive. Now, does that mean they didn't need insulin? Of course, they needed insulin.
Sure, you need a little bit of insulin.
Yeah,
so you can't have no insulin.
And besides, even if you just eat protein and fat, you're still going to have gluconeogenesis.
Exactly, and you're going to... Yeah,
your
pancreas would still
And also you're going to waste away. You're going to
Burn you're not going to store
muscle.
Any fat at all.
You're going to burn down your muscle.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, it's not the answer without insulin, but it will do is it will minimize your insulin. Now, you know, trick question is, well, why not take a lot of insulin? What's the problem?
Oh my goodness! Well, insulin is a very important hormone, helping with managing blood glucose, but also, it's a hormone of inflammation.
Yep.
It's a hormone of fat storage.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to think of it that way. I'm thinking of a case study right now. We had a patient some years ago. I think he was from the Boston area, came down to see us, an insulin-dependent type 1 diabetic. This was a man in his 60s. I think he was in his late 60s. He's like, he was 50 pounds overweight.
Yep.
Well, he was counting his carbohydrates as he was taught to do. And taking the required amount of insulin.
He was a fat type 1 diabetic.
Exactly. Yeah. So I said, no, listen, you need to be on a lower carb diet so you could administer less insulin to yourself. Lo and behold, several months later, he dropped about 40 pounds after that.
Yeah.
And he was ecstatic.
And let's keep in mind, you know, why do diabetics die? Well, they rarely die of diabetes alone. I mean, people do have decompensation where they have diabetic ketoacidosis and they die, you know, of that rarely.
Mm-hmm.
They may develop the complications of diabetes, such as eye problems and nerve problems and neuropathy and lose limbs and so on.
Kidneys.
But why they die is mostly cardiovascular disease.
Yeah.
So, you know, if they're obese and if they have high triglycerides and, you know, and inflamed, they will have premature death.
Exactly.
And
people with diabetes progress 70% faster to cardiovascular disease than those who don't. And the primary variable there is about insulin.
Yeah.
Hyperinsulinism in the type 2 diabetic who's still secreting insulin, but in the type 1 who's administering himself too much insulin.
Now that it's in the Times, I hope they remember that over 100 years ago, in 1910, Banting was talking about this. And Joslin was talking about this.
Yeah.
And then this is like forgotten wisdom.
Exactly.
That for a century, it has been eclipsed with this wrong-headed...
We have insulin now. Problem solved.
You know
I remember.
You know who I blame?
Hmm.
The ADA.
Yes. American Diabetes Association.
Well, and the
American, American Dietetic Association.
Which changed its initials, by the way.
Right.
But I remember, you know, like those, the equivalents. What was it called? The carbohydrate
counting.
Counting, right.
You know, you had your 5 grams were all your vegetables, which is what we want to continue to eat.
Yeah.
But fruit, bread, and milk were higher. These are the things you really had to count. And guess what? When a type 1 diabetic embarks on a low-carb diet, like they're saying in the New York Times can be helpful, and they administer less insulin, they have less swings in blood sugar.
The brittleness of the diabetes is,
you know, one of the dangers of for type 1 diabetics is because they're administering all this insulin.
Hypoglycemia.
You know, if you wind up in insulin shock. You wind up in the ER.
You can be driving along in a car, all of a sudden you hit a brick wall, or, you know, you run over somebody you don't even know. And then they arrest you. They arrest you for DUI. Unless you have one of those med alert bracelets
on.
Because for all the world, you seem
fruity
drunk.
Fruity breath.
You seem drunk.
Yeah, that too.
You have fruity breath too. Right. But, you know, you just seem drunk and disoriented, you know. Because of low blood sugar.
Right. So a low-carb diet is still the antidote, even for type 1 diabetics. They could take the least amount of insulin, and they have more tight glycemic control, which is exactly what you want. You don't want all these variations.
So the question is, and I know it's a bit of an essay question, but in the short answer, please, how low can you go? As low as in type 2 diabetes?
No, you can't. Because,
I agree.
The parameters change.
Yes.
Just like in chronic kidney disease, where the BUN, the creatinine are now different numbers. But in a type 1 diabetic, they may feel hypoglycemic at a blood sugar of 85.
Okay.
Whereas that's kind of normal for most people. Mm-hmm. And for somebody without diabetes at all, 65, 68 is pretty good. A type 1 diabetic with a blood sugar of 65, 68, they might be shaking or tremoring.
Okay.
It's too low for them.
So what would you say? How many percentage, or is there a rule of thumb on that, or carbs?
Well, it kind of depends per person. But again, we like to keep it at under 30 grams or so.
Okay.
And it kind of varies between, you know.
Okay.
And you also have to factor in still what the person is going to comply with, what they're going to eat, or they're going to insist on that sweet potato or something.
Yeah. And some of it is, you know, how dedicated a patient you can be.
That's
now, if you're Dr. Richard Bernstein, who is actually the most disciplined person I've ever seen, you know, he would stick himself 16 times a day to check his blood sugar and then eat or not eat accordingly and to use some insulin and, you know, and exercise like a demon, he could get away with it.
Yeah.
And the guy's not a youngster. I know he was already in med school. He was already 10 years older than me.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, you know, very, you know, well at and active, and you know, as a diabetic, he's a wonderful success through his method. So he's, you know, an N of one experiment of what that can do.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm glad at least that, I mean, credit to the Times that they're shedding light on a subject.
Mm-hmm.
But again, they're not exactly, I would say, at the vanguard of nutrition.
You know what? This also brings to mind something I've been reading about recently that I'm a little bit disturbed by. More new doctors, younger doctors coming out of med school are using insulin more in type 2.
Oh, I can't.
For the management of type 2, which I'm kind of disturbed about. No, take some insulin instead of.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons is because how crappy some of these diabetes drugs are.
That's true.
I think that the reason for that is that they don't prove to extend life.
Yeah.
They lower blood sugar, but they have many side effects.
Sulfonylureas and stuff. But we like metformin.
We do. And we have a question about that, I think.
Yes, we do. We do.
So, I'm sorry, that's all the time we have for today. So, it's been great. The digressions sometimes take longer than the questions. Do you want to go to the top with that question about metformin?
Exactly,
okay.
Exactly. This is from Gabriella. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, is metformin really a wonder drug? Recent studies show it has cancer-fighting powers, decreases mammographic breast density.
Oh,
I've not heard that.
I don't know that.
People taking it for prediabetes and type 2 outlive those with normal blood sugar who do not take the drug. I neither have high blood sugar nor cancer, but should I ask my doctor for metformin?
It's very interesting. You know, metformin has a very interesting history. It's actually discovered as a derivative of something called goat's rue, which is a botanical.
Mm-hmm.
And it's now chemically synthesized. I don't think they, you know, pound some goat's rue and run it through, you know, filters or something. It's synthetically made.
Mm-hmm.
But it is it's still not exactly clear how it works. It works on multiple signaling systems in the body. And as such, it does, I don't find that it so much lowers blood sugar, it sensitizes the cells to your own insulin.
Yeah.
So if you're not making enough insulin, or if you're making too much but you're very insulin resistant, it will actually help.
Yeah.
And typically it'll help you get your hemoglobin A1C down, but it doesn't dangerously lower blood sugar like taking too much insulin.
Yeah.
What's interesting is the research now shows that metformin works on the microbiome. It changes the microbiome. And by changing the microbiome, it may therefore modify the body's response to carbohydrates.
Yeah.
It works in a way similar to berberine, mm-hmm. which is an extract of golden seal and Oregon grape root,
mm-hmm.
Which also used to be used mostly, I use it for people who had diarrhea, you know, as an intestinal cleanser kind mm-hmm. of. It's a antimicrobial.
Mm-hmm.
But in so doing, it alters the microbiome, maybe in a way similar to metformin. In toe-to-toe comparisons, berberine works mm-hmm. As well as metformin in some studies. But metformin also has some effects on brain
mm-hmm.
in terms of slowing brain aging. It seems to have anti-cancer effects, and it's actually, there's some clinical trials where people are getting metformin while they're getting chemo
yes.
or after they've gotten chemo
yeah.
to prevent recurrence.
Mm-hmm.
And I have several patients who have cancers, and we want to prevent them from getting recurrences with breast cancer especially, and uterine mm-hmm. cancer, and prostate cancer. I have them on metformin.
Terrific.
And metformin is generally well tolerated. It does cause some GI upset because it does work on the GI
tract. It can, yeah. Some people will experience diarrhea in the beginning. It mm-hmm. should clear up in a few weeks. They might do better with the extended release.
Also keep in mind, when you take metformin, you probably should take a little B12 because,
yes.
and this happened to one of our patients recently, he's on metformin for, I don't know what, but not for diabetes, I think for cancer.
Mm.
And he came in with a very low B12.
Yeah.
So that was, remember, it's one of our prostate cancer patients.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think we checked his B12 was like 200.
Right. That's very low.
Yeah. So
yeah.
we don't want to, that is one of the drug interactions, mm-hmm. drug nutrient interactions mm-hmm. of metformin. Well, you know, what was interesting about metformin is it was taken off the market for a while because it was found that in very sick patients,
mm-hmm.
You know, patients with kidney failure or, you know, like in the intensive care unit, that it could actually cause lactic acidosis, which is a devastating pH imbalance in the body.
Wow.
And so it was banned in the United States for a while, and it's one of the few drugs that was banned, and it's come back.
Hmm.
And it's come back, and I still think it's the oldest, but it's the most effective oral diabetes drug around.
Yes, yes.
And it's not that potent, really, but it's...
Right, right. And metformin is known as glucophage.
Glucophage as well,
yeah.
right.
Yeah. So this is very interesting. I'm going to have to look into...
There's a study, and I mentioned, I think,
yeah.
before. There's a study at my alma mater, Einstein, where they're taking... They have... One of the things about where Einstein is in the Bronx, it's a Jewish institution,
mm-hmm.
and there's a lot of old Jews in the Bronx. I can attest to that because, when I was in my training, there wouldn't be a day that would go by that... Uh-huh. You know, a Bertha or a Bessie or, a Sylvia would come in with congestive heart failure, and for her 99th admission, at the age of 88 or 92 or uh-huh. 101, and so they're doing a project.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Jacques Barzelay is the name of the doctor who is doing a study on the elderly to see if metformin will extend life. Basically,
mm-hmm.
and they're well elderly, and he's also doing other studies on what is it that makes some people live longer. That certain genes or certain lifestyle characteristics will help people live longer.
I remember a study being done that the criteria that the people who live the longest into their hundreds have, the criteria are they have a high HDL. They are insulin sensitive, meaning a low
mm-hmm.
insulin
yeah.
and low triglycerides.
Okay.
Those are the three.
Right.
Most of all.
So when you're planning how much money you need to save for retirement, you could look, you put those into like a machine learning.
Exactly.
And it'll tell you how many years you have to save for.
Exactly. And of course, when you cross the street, you have to look both ways and backwards and forwards so you don't get hit by a bus.
Right. Cause that could blow the whole equation.
Exactly.
Right? It's the stage of my life, you know, where the thing will, you know, how much money do you need to save? Or should I start spending it down? Or should I keep saving it? And it's sort of like, well, you know, I don't know, because my grandfather lived to be 101.
Mm. So there's longevity in your family.
It seems like I've saved some money, but maybe that could go pretty quickly when you live to be 101.
Okay. So this is very interesting what Gabriella says about decreasing breast density. I have to look into that.
That's interesting.
That's very important.
One thing that, you know, will help with that.
Yeah. Fish
oil, definitely.
Yeah.
But also for painful cystic breasts, iodine.
Iodine
is wonderful.
Yeah.
So,
Okay. So, Gabriella, thank you for that. We have a question from Mark. We have two questions from Mark. Hi, Dr. Hoffman. I was wondering if a gastroenterologist can tell if one has leaky gut during a colonoscopy.
And the answer is no, because it's a microscopic thing.
Yeah.
When you look at colonoscopy, you see only what's called macroscopic changes, which means visible to the naked eye, or in this case, to a magnifier, you know, which is the fiber optic scope.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't see microscopic changes. Microscopic changes have to be found only with a biopsy, but a biopsy of dead tissue won't show you those changes because it's devitalized tissue. You probably could do some maybe specialized technique of live microscopy or electron microscopy where you could see the tight junctions open up and you could actually see the leakage.
Yeah.
But it's more of a functional test for leaky gut, which is a lactulose mannitol test.
Mm-hmm.
So the lactulose molecule is big and the mannitol molecule is small. So the idea is you want to keep the big stuff out and you want to let the small stuff pass. And if you get a high mannitol and a low, if you have a low mannitol and a high lactulose, that's leaky gut.
Mm-hmm.
It's too much of the big molecules are getting through and not enough of the small molecules are getting through.
Right.
And that's done by a challenge. You take a lactulose mannitol challenge. And
it's an oral challenge.
Oral challenge. Yeah. And then it gets absorbed into your bloodstream and, through the intestinal tract.
Yeah.
And then comes out in your pee.
Mm-hmm.
And you collect your urine, you see how much of those substances come out. It's kind of an ingenious test. It's not a perfect test, but it does, you know, speak to the likelihood of a leaky gut.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a test we do with the Hoffman's, you know, at the practice here.
Yeah. So Mark's second question, he's a 55-year-old male. He says, I eat a keto diet, drink beer occasionally, very low-carb beer about once a week. Okay. Do cardio and weights, and I'm in good shape with maybe 10 to 15 pounds I'd like to lose. I'm on no meds except testosterone. I take 21 supplements daily, mostly the ones you talk about, nothing exotic.
Yeah.
I've had pretty severe acne for about a year.
And
I've tried to isolate the cause.
How about testosterone being the cause?
Yeah.
Right.
Mark, how long have you been taking that testosterone?
I mean, testosterone is certainly associated with acne. And, you know, it has desirable effects, but in some people they're very susceptible to acne. Now, testosterone doesn't always cause acne.
Mm-hmm.
An example of which is women who have PCOS or they have hyperandrogenism, they may have more acne.
Yeah.
When I see these women, I'm puzzled because, you know, I measure their testosterone and their testosterone is like 1/10 or 1/15 of mine. And I don't have acne. So it can't be just the amount of testosterone.
But don't women generally have 1/10 or 1/15 of a man's testosterone?
Or less. Yeah.
Okay.
It's also a microbiome disorder, which has to do with the intestinal microbiome.
Yes.
And it also has to do with the surface microbiome of the skin.
Yeah.
And, I'm actually working with somebody, right now to look at, when you make, skin preparations for acne. I mean, an ideal skin preparation for acne would restore the natural microbiome.
Yeah.
But you can't sell a live bacteria
Right.
Because you can't put it in a bottle and then say, smear it on your face. There's some, yeah. It's just not going to be approved by the, I guess the FDA, the Cosmetic Bureau, has certain standards. Mm-hmm. You can't, put live bacteria in your skin. Mm-hmm. So what we're looking at is the possibility of using skin prebiotics to encourage the growth of the beneficial bacteria and maybe some gentle
flowy for skin.
Yeah, something to put,
something like that.
Yeah, something that's good. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I would, Mark, I would also take a look at your supplements, maybe DHEA, maybe contributing to the acne.
That's possible. Now, I think you mentioned that some patients that you see have problems with fish oil.
Yes.
And fish oil may promote acne.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm 54.
Iodine can promote acne.
Yeah, I'm 54 now, but in my early 40s, late 30s, if I took fish oil, I got terrible acne. Mm-hmm. This is no longer the case.
Okay.
Which is yay.
Yeah.
So I can take fish oil without a problem.
And that may be a result in changes in your hormones.
Right, right. Iodine, maybe the iodine in a multi can cause a detox reaction that can cause.
Yeah, iodine is sometimes associated with acne.
Yeah, something like that. And Mark, if you're taking a lot of B vitamins, it could contribute to acne that's already present or make it more
severe.
It's hard
to know because,
it is hard to know.
When you take a lot of vitamins, you change the quality of the oils in your skin.
That's true.
In unpredictable ways and maybe in a way that feeds the bacteria. So maybe, take a hiatus and see if it is those things that you're taking that are making a difference.
Right, right.
All right. Time flies when you're having fun. And here we are.
Wow, that was part one?
That was
it?
That's it.
Wow.
One and done. So what we'll do is pause and allow our listeners to fast forward to part two. And in part two, give us an introduction to what we're going to tackle.
How to help with oral lichen planus.
Oh, okay. It's a challenging problem.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about it in part two. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman here today with Layla Mutin, our nutritionist in residence. We share the podium each week for our weekly Q&A with Layla. Radio program at AOL.com is the place to send questions, so have at it if you have something you want us to answer. We'll be right back.